Welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. And this is our first broadcast of the new year. Happy 2016. Best wishes for a happy new year to all concerned, especially persons of goodwill, friends of the program, and any others that might happen to be listening in. It's a new year, and it comes in the thick now of big doings in political economy, in politics, all kinds of interesting historical, philosophical questions being thrown up, and we're ready to handle them. This is going to be a big year for the Tax Wall Street Party and the United Front Against Austerity, which I always have a tendency to call the United Front Against Fascism, because that sort of is the idea, right? That if you have that much austerity, Shaktian killer genocidal austerity, then you basically have economic fascism. And that's the danger that we have to fight against. Now, just looking back, right, to maybe kick off the new year with an optimistic note, which is perhaps a little bit hard to find in some of the day-to-day news. January 6th, 1941, Franklin D. Roosevelt's State of the Union Address, in which he evoked for the first time the four freedoms, the four freedoms being freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from fear, freedom from want, those four. And that, of course, is the platform of the what soon became the United Nations, right? The Allies soon becoming the United Nations in the battle against fascism. The main issue of the middle 20th century and down to our own time is fascism. It must be stopped. It must be identified, denounced, defeated. Doesn't matter who it is. And don't be afraid. It's time to get going. It's time to fight fascism. And, of course, the four freedoms were then incorporated into the Atlantic Charter, which was the Anglo-American, the U.S.-British convergence alliance, in effect, although informal, that was sealed on a British battleship. I think it's the King George V, about to be sunk by the Japanese a little bit later in the same year. But it's the Atlantic Charter. So the program, the platform upon which the United States was then to wage war, freedom from fear, freedom from want, freedom of speech, freedom of religion. And the freedom from want concerns us, freedom from fear, certainly, in the days of FBI COINTELPRO and massive surveillance, right? We want to have freedom from fear and freedom from want. And that then developed by January 1944. I think it's January 11th. So that's going to be a couple of days after this broadcast is first heard. The freedom from want gets you into the eight points that Roosevelt wanted incorporated in the U.S. Constitution. And it should have been done. But, of course, Harry Truman was a contemptible little puppet of Averell Harriman and essentially the Skull and Bones group, right, who took over the Harry Truman government. That would be Dean Acheson of Wolf's Head Secret Society, but above all, W. Averell Harriman of Brown Brothers Harriman, Skull and Bones, and behind him, of course, Prescott Bush, the managing partner, the guy who did all the work in the back office of Brown Brothers Harriman, and Prescott Bush, his spawn is still active, trying to oppress people today in the form of Jeb Bush. So we'd like to see that political dynasty pass from the pages of history. Anyway, thank you to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, January 6th, 1941. Interesting also that Sir Winston Churchill refused to apply that declaration to many parts of the British Empire, including above all India. When people in India came forward and said, we'd like to have the benefits of that declaration, he said, no, that's only for the North Atlantic and essentially only a piece of propaganda. And we'll be looking at the British this week and in the coming weeks. We have to now call attention of the public to the existence of a sinister Sino-British bloc, which has emerged now in the last couple of months. We've been giving hints about it, and now we have more details, and it is a horrendous development. So a Sino-British bloc, and we'll also be calling it an Anglo-Chinese bloc. It's Britain and China against the world, and we'll go through some of that in detail. But now we have to be concerned with malheur, that is to say, misfortune, tragedy. This is some strange coincidence, I think, but it's the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in sort of southeastern Oregon, where we have an armed gang, a group of armed thugs, armed hoodlums, acting in flagrant violation of the law and getting away with it. They're obviously the pampered darlings of the FBI, the lapdogs of the FBI. Nothing radical about these guys. And it's now clear for everybody to see. They are the creatures of the COINTELPRO apparatus. These people have COINTELPRO written all over them. We have to see them as a false flag. They claim to be some kind of spontaneous rebellion against an oppressive state authority. Well, we know that Cliven, or as I call him, Cloven Bundy. Cloven Bundy has a private airplane. Okay, how many of you have private airplanes? But old Cloven has one. So these people are not hurting. They are not suffering. They are wealthy or well-to-do reactionaries who want to steal federal land. They want to do a land grab. Their program is a land grab. Now, this has been happening now for the last week. It happened, I guess, started on Saturday, January 1st. So we've now had 1 month of these characters. So the Bundy gang, it means Amon. Every time I say this, I'm thinking of Amon Ra. Are they really pagans? Well, pagans they are. They're Mormons. These are reactionary, fanatical Mormons. They are white supremacists. Make no mistake. Anti-Semitism, we'll be looking for that too, given where this stuff is coming from. So they're all packing heat. They've all got guns. They're armed to the teeth. There's obviously some kind of a psychological problem going on, right? Certain deficiencies that some of these characters may have, and they try to make up for it by packing heat. And this, of course, is this absolutely infantile and destructive to civilization. So they showed up. It was essentially a demonstration, as people know, to try to protest the renewed jailing of a father and a son from the local Hammond family. The issue here had been setting backfires on the Hammond land some years ago. That then became a fire on public land. The facts of this are hard to tell. One interesting thing, though, is that the local feds, right, the federal prosecutors say that the goal of the Hammonds was to cover up the evidence of poaching that they were doing on federal land. If people know about this, I would be interested to hear about it one way or the other. So this I do not know. So there was a peaceful demonstration. The people who came to that peaceful demonstration were not warned. They were not given a heads up that there would then be a transition into an armed seizure of a federal building with a program of a land grab. So a lot of people very resentful of the Bundy family for essentially duping them, luring them into a kind of a trap. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Carpenter in Washington, D.C. It's the afternoon of Friday, the 8th of January, 2016. We're into the new year. We just had Epiphany. Naturally, we try to arrange an epiphany every week on this broadcast where you get to see into the essence of things, right? You get to see the face of reality in the way that the Oriental kings, right, the Magi, were able to do when they reached Bethlehem, according to the scripture. So, we're talking the Bundy Caliphate. We're talking Cloven Bundy of Southern Nevada, Mormon fanatic, right? Interesting question. Is polygamy going on there? Well, we don't know, but it would be highly interesting. So they show up on the scene. The Hammond family doesn't want them. Burns, Oregon, doesn't want them. And they occupy this building. They claim to have 200 people. The best estimate is fewer than 20. Fewer than 20. And they are getting the kid glove treatment. How about this? 20 black militants armed with rifles and shotguns take over the federal building. Where would it be? Say in New York or some other urban locality. What do you think would happen in those cases? Now, the relevance of this is I'm not urging the National Guard or something to go in there and start another massacre with large amounts of casualties. But the thing that's going on here is that people have seen terrorism, right? There's been a change in the view by many Americans. Terrorism, ISIS, San Bernardino, Paris, and so forth. We don't like armed gangs. Armed gangs are getting to look very similar. So terrorism has done part of this work. And then Ferguson and Staten Island and other places, East Baltimore, West Baltimore, these have shown what happens if the system considers you a threat. What happens to you is that this violence comes down on your head, and it's overdone. It's overzealous. It's not about restoring order. It's about trying to make a bloody example of some people so that other people will essentially become more docile. So look at these people. They're supposedly radical, right? Oh, those are libertarians. Boy, oh boy. Those Mormon fanatics, boy, they're really tough guys. But now it's, look at it. It's so absurd. They're not considered a threat by the FBI. As I said before, they are the coddled lapdogs. They are the darlings of the power structure and the FBI. So now these characters, these wealthy white guys in cowboy hats and cowboy boots, are standing there with no radical cover. There's no radical cover. If you want to have a fascist militia, you've got to have radical cover. And we went through this in previous weeks, right? The art of fascism is to seem to be threatening the financiers, the bankers, the factory owners, but in reality, you're not proposing anything that would even inconvenience the imperialist finance bourgeoisie in any way. And that's what we're seeing, that the if you don't have some kind of radical cover, if you don't seem to be a threat to the system, well, then you're standing there. And what we're getting is an uprising of public opinion, right? People saying, one guy wrote a letter to the Washington Post here. He says, I want those hoodlums off my land. In other words, public land belongs to the American people. It is not to be appropriated by some gun-toting moron who shows up and spouts some theory. We'll talk about the theory in a second. This cannot be allowed. So the experience of terrorism means that people don't want to put up with this stuff, right? They've had enough of it, enough with the guns. And Ferguson and Baltimore and all of these other places, it shows you what happens if they really do consider you some kind of a threat. And again, these guys are getting essentially a free ride. So these are people who want things for free. They say that they want to privatize public land at gunpoint. It's impossible. They want to have a Homestead Act for survivalists. How about that? Greedy, right-wing, reactionary racists. And who's going to get excited about that? That's freedom. That's libertarianism. And this, of course, is now the moment where the absolute moral and intellectual bankruptcy of libertarianism, of the Austrian school, of the Paul-tard dynasty, Ron Paul, Rand Paul, and so forth, that bankruptcy is now exposed for all to see. And this thing is going over like a lead balloon. Everybody's running away from it. Sheriff Ward, who has emerged as an interesting figure, is saying, why don't you guys go home? Why don't you leave us alone? The kids in this place, Burns and surrounding areas, it's a very large county with only about 3,000 people in it. They say, why don't you go home and leave us alone, and then our children can start going back to school. And, of course, Ammon and Ryan Bundy say, no, we have to stay here and fight for what, the sovereign individual, for freedom. When he says liberty, you can read license, because that's what he's got in mind. And, they said, we're going to study who really owns this land. And this is a tremendous comic interlude where the libertarians are out there posturing, right, waving their guns and posturing that that this is an outrage, and that they're going to find out who really owns the land and restore it to the real owners. And then the local Indian tribe shows up and says, not so fast, white man. This is our land. So, that they opened that can of worms, and now they're getting what they seem to have sown. That is what they are reaping. Now, in our briefing, right? You got to keep up with the briefing. Again, go to tarpley.net and go and click on any of the briefings, and it will take you to a box where you can type in your email and so forth, and begin getting the daily briefing of the Tax Wall Street Party. I try to write for it just about every day, as much as I can. And what you'll find in there is how this all unfolded. But in particular, the theory of land titles that these characters have, these survivalists, what are we going to call them? And indeed, we do need a more effective catch-all. This is classic Brigham Young. Brigham Young, fanatic Mormon theories of land titles. But the federal government has no vote. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. January 8th is the time we're putting this together. So, fascism and the role of armed gangs, right? Militias. The German term for militias of this type is Freikorps, Freikorps. And if we look at the development of fascism and Nazism in Germany, we see that there's a central role, absolutely critical role, played by armed gangs. Starting off in the Baltic states, as Germany was collapsing at the end of the war, that is to say what then became Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, sometimes in Poland and similar areas. These Freikorps, these militias that have formed in those areas and some others, are then pulled back to Berlin, where they are put to work with essentially political assassinations. They assassinate the two heads of the Communist Party, Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht. And a little bit later, Rosa Luxemburg's common-law husband, Leon Jogiches, written Jogiches. So these are the Freikorps. We also see, in particular in the agricultural setting, right, the farm sector, this interesting novelist, right, Hans Fallada. He is the classic German writer about the events of the 1920s and 30s, right, the period between the two world wars, the Weimar Republic and the hyperinflation and the depression then in 1929. And the interesting book here is called Bauern, Bonzen und Bomben. So peasants, bureaucrats, and bombs. And it has to do with the Landvolk, the rural people's movement, in Schleswig-Holstein. It means right under Denmark. There was a series of parallel events that led to the bombing of public buildings and indeed the bombing of the Reichstag in Berlin. 5 years before Hitler and company burned down the German parliament, it was these farmers, right, some provocateurs undoubtedly in their ranks, who then went to Berlin and tried to blow up the building. So that's another one. And then we have this period of street fighting, right, where you have the Nazis against the communists, NSDAP against KPD, and the armed militias are in the center of it all. Earlier in Italy, you had had the debut, really, of fascists, fascist gangs as strikebreakers, was that you had a movement of the agricultural day laborers, right? Braceros in Spanish, well, braccianti in Italian. So the braccianti are landless, impoverished day laborers, and they decide to say, well, let's, in this period when the workers in, you know, Milan and Turin are in, occupying the factories, they say, let's us seize some land for ourselves. So the latifundists, right, the huge feudal landlords, right, reactionary, horrendous people, bring in the fascists and say, kick these peasants, because they're not even peasants, right, kick these vagrants, really, they would say, off my land, right? So we don't want armed gangs. It is the negation of the benefits of the modern state, right, which is under feudalism, you have incessant private warfare. It's the curse of the whole society. You can make no progress because you've got private warfare going on all the time. And we have now, we have private warfare going on in Burns, Iowa. How about this? Inter-fascist conflict. Some guy called Lewis Arthur of Veterans on Patrol shows up, and he wants to talk to the Bundy honchos, and they get into a fist fight, and Arthur is there with a somewhat smaller group, right? He's less less of a following, but he says, I want to try to save the women and children from this group. By the way, nobody knows if there are women or children or really anything about it. As a matter of fact, it, you know, it could be fewer than 20. We don't really know. So, we get then, the charge from Lewis Arthur is that the Bundy gang attacked him. So there we are, private warfare. And I urge you to think, suppose you had been driving in that southern tip of Nevada last April when Cloven Bundy put on his big show. You had snipers with loaded guns pointing at federal officials from, you know, sniper nests, right, from undercover. And the federal officials were threatened. And then suppose you were just passing through, right? You're a tourist, right? You're going from, what, California to Arizona or something like this, and you decide to take this route. Suppose you're stopped at gunpoint by some armed thug spouting libertarianism and sovereign individual. They point the gun at you. They say, get out of your car. Hands up. I'm going to search your car. And then they say, where are you going? What are you going to do? What are your plans? And on and on and on. You want that? No. We want the United States government. If the state won't do it, the United States government has got to protect citizens from that kind of a shakedown. Because what could come next, right? Robbery, rape, and there's nothing to stop it. It can simply go on and on. So this is out of this world. We have to have a climate of nonviolence, in effect, right? And if people insist on violence and posturing, again, out of God knows what twisted psychological needs that they have for these weapons that they seem to attach so much importance to, well, then that has to be prevented. Now, of course, this does not bear really on this gun debate. The gun debate is essentially, as I've said before, leave it alone. Obviously, these minor adjustments in the check system, right? The method of determining if you're crazy or if you're a criminal, and so forth. I think that's fine. But other than that, we should just leave this alone, because you can see that this is a point where a lot of people, they get very upset very fast. It's not worth it. The way you pacify society is the way I say, which is 30 million new productive jobs and probably 10 million summer jobs, temporary jobs, jobs to introduce people or reintroduce them into the workforce. So the situation is, oh, let's just go through the thing about the land titles, right? I urge people to get my book, Just Too Weird. Bishop Romney and the Mormon takeover of America, polygamy, theocracy, and subversion. I have to say, if I do say so myself, without any false modesty, this is absolutely essential. If you want to know what the Ron Paul presidential campaign was, this is where you find out. And if you want to know what these Mormons are up to, go to page 119. And, well, in that chapter, right, secessionism, secession and insurrection, Mormon theocracy during the 1850s, the first state that seceded was Utah under a theocracy and a dictator, and the guy is Brigham Young. He's got a secret intelligence agency. It's called the Danites. And maybe the Danites are, at work there in Burns. But in particular, there is this question of, the land titles. And the Mormon argument was essentially, well, we're the Mormons, we're the Latter-day Saints, and we get our land titles from God. And as long as it was Mexico, right, which it was up until 1848, you could get away with that. But then comes the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo between Mexico and the United States, restores peace February 2nd, 1848. The territory of Utah becomes part of the United States, and the land titles are not valid, the ones that had been issued by Mexico and then eagerly bought by the Mormons. So the result is this conflict. The land titles and deeds granted by Deseret, meaning the Mormon pseudo-state, during the first years of settlement were all of a sudden not valid. When U.S. federal officials arrived in Deseret for the purpose of beginning the surveying of land, they were subjected to extreme harassment. And this then went on. Read all about it, page 117 and following in Just Too Weird. You can get that at tarpley.net. And please do. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. So wrapping up our profile of the malheur, the tragedy for the United States that we have such backward, ignorant people, and so many people have been willing to listen to this stuff. I think this entire phenomenon is now moribund. In other words, the political expression of libertarianism, in particular in the Paul Tard phenomenon, right? Ron is now a stock salesman, stock jobber. I guess that's where his mind always was. And now little Rand, it's always touch and go. Will he get through? Can he survive to the next Republican debate and what have you, right? Because he's barely moving the needle, right? And this is a U.S. senator with that entire fundraising base that they unscrupulously got out of the 9/11 truth movement. So no great heroism for the people who made that possible. Therefore, this is, I hope, sincerely coming to an early end. And again, I want those hoodlums off our property now, sums it up for quite a few. Get a hold of that book on Romney, Just Too Weird. You get the entire thing about Mormonism, right? In the past, the Mountain Meadows Massacre was carried out against people from Arkansas who were trying to get to California. And the Mormon argument was, your animals have eaten off our vegetation, and therefore we kill you. And that was ordered by Brigham Young in the first person, right? He did it. So this is now the situation. Now let's since we're on domestic, let's transition to related questions. One of the great promises, as we've always argued, is that Donald Trump, as a fascist, right, as an outspoken, bombastic, impudent fascist, could become the wrecking ball of the Republican Party. He could become the Samson who pulls down the temple of these Republican Philistines and finishes off the Republican Party as a national force. Now, the connection is this. If you look at the people in Burns, Oregon, you can say that's the armed goon wing of Trump, of Trumpism. Sure thing. That's who that is. And it's highly interesting to see how many, in particular last year, right, when the votes were further away, the candidates who strongly supported Cloven Bundy when he had those snipers out there in the desert threatening federal officials, Rand Paul fell all over himself to support Cloven Bundy, right? And he went and pandered to him for an hour, and then Bundy came out and said his philosophy is not quite right in this lunatic padded cell of libertarianism. He says, I already have stewardship. I don't want ownership. I just claimed rights, and I set little Rand straight on that. Ted Cruz aligned himself with Bundy in April 2014. Ben Carson was a vocal supporter of Bundy. Then Donald Trump endorsed him in general, but he told him to make a deal now at the best terms he could get. Huckabee went there. I'm sorry, didn't go there, but he supported it in a general way from a distance. Okay, so this is, generally speaking, this is the armed fascist wing of the Republican Party. That's who they are. And if you need something for strike breaking, I'm sure they're available. Remember what they say, that they want all the lands restored, and they want that for farming, for ranching, for mining, for logging and recreation. What does that mean? Hotels. So essentially what they're opening the door to is fracking, this wretched backward technology that essentially gets you going on the wrong foot. Strip mining, why not? Or putting up hotels, why not? So, and all with free land. In other words, this is not the Homestead Act for the people. This is Homestead Act for ideologues and plutocrats. Now, the big thing about this was when that happened, the feds backed off. Kid glove treatment began in April of 2014, and you watched it, right? Here we have armed lunatics pointing guns at federal officials, and at a certain point, the U.S. Officials simply leave the scene and leave the guy there. So they've essentially encouraged and enabled the current outbreak. So according to Justin Raimondo of Anti-War, he says, well, those the libertarians are going to hang tough because that's their nature. But the feds are going to have to move in, he says, because the feds had the problem that they backed down the previous time. Yeah. And why did they do that? So if you don't see the FBI supporting these people, I don't know what it's going to take. In April 2014, the FBI, hands off, never laid a glove on them, even the ones that were pointing loaded weapons. Then this week, what's been going on? 7 days? How long do you think you could do that in any other setting other than this one? And it's simply encouraging them. The fact that they're failing politically is their own problem, but it's clear the FBI is doing everything they can to make this work, make it easier for them. And then how about this? Remember that guy Ron Kokesh? He was the one who wanted to lead a parade of disgruntled right-wing veterans with rifles into the District of Columbia, where this is illegal. And then later he went down to Freedom Plaza here on Pennsylvania Avenue. We can see the Capitol, and he brought this shotgun, which he proceeded to load demonstratively. And then he was finally rounded up. They kept him in jail for, what, 2 or 3 months from July to November? And then he got what? 2 years probation. 2 years probation. Not very draconian, is it? So, time served plus 2 years probation. And by the way, they call this nonviolent. It's, if you bring along pistols and rifles and even machine guns, for all we know, it's not nonviolent. It's something quite different. As Sheriff Ward said, right? Thank you for calling public attention to this, but as soon as you show up with guns, this is no longer civil disobedience. It's no longer a peaceful protest. You're going off the deep end. So those are the terms, but you got to see it in the context that I've said. These are not just crackpots who are out there on their own. This is, in effect, the right wing, the goon wing, the squadristi or Sturmabteilung wing of the Republican Party, and indeed of Trump. Now, let's start looking at the vote totals. You got to keep up with something like Real Clear Politics these days. It's an interesting and exciting time in a number of ways, right? Given all the things that are going on. Let's see. Why don't we just run down what the situation is here. In terms, as of this current moment, the Iowa Republican caucus, Cruz is leading Trump by 4 percentage points. In the New Hampshire Republican primary, Trump is leading, he's leading Rubio. Trump is leading Rubio by 13.2%. South Carolina Republican primary, Trump leading Cruz by 11%. Democratic caucus in Iowa, Hillary leading Bernie by 12.5%. New Hampshire Democratic primary, Bernie leading Hillary by 2.5%. South Carolina, it's Clinton by 40% over Bernie. So you get the idea. But now, let's see about Trump and Cruz, okay? And we'll be back in just a minute. Welcome to the second hour of World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley starting off the new year of 2016 with our first broadcast and wishing everybody all the best in the new year. Now, just a couple of other notes. The people who are supporting the Bundy gang the most seem to be the sort of older libertarians, right, who are now essentially adrift morally and intellectually. Maybe they always were. Paul Craig Roberts actually argues that what the Bundys are trying to obtain is the rule of law. Well, I'm very sorry. That's not the rule of law. The rule of law is done with voting, with gathering signatures to get on the ballot, with raising money, with giving speeches, with going on the radio and explaining what your program is. How about the fact that they don't even seem to have a leaflet saying what it is they want? It's all, they're winging it, right? They're just doing it off the top of their heads. I would say to these people, you're cowards because you're afraid to face the problems of political organizing and also of trying to win elections, right? If your program is so popular, then run for office. What else do we have under this system? There is no way to short circuit our political system by picking up the gun. You do that, you're putting yourself in a very destructive position, and bad news. Justin Raimondo says, oh, those guys out there are resisting and they must be defeated. In an era where fascism is clearly on the agenda, the idea that somebody is, you know, beating up cops or pointing guns at federal officials, this guarantees absolutely nothing, because that's what fascists did. We just went through it, right? The gangs, the Italian fascist gangs of 1920, 21, 22, and the German counterparts working off that during this farming interlude and then in the final struggle for power, 1929 to 1934. Okay? So that kind of radicalism guarantees nothing. Again, the interesting thing is that the Bundy gang has lost pretty much any radical cover because they're obviously being coddled. They're being propped up by the FBI, right? Even when the local sheriff has seen through these characters for what they are. So, also, William Bloom, the great anti-imperialist, sends out a thing where he's, you know, essentially flirting with Trumpism. It shows that there's a certain kind of leftist that has almost zero resistance to actual fascism. It's unfortunate. This is also not new, right? A petty bourgeois leftist can be dragged along with the other petty bourgeois right-wingers, right, whatever, into the support of a fascist movement. And remember, the big numbers for Mussolini and Hitler, middle-class people who are afraid of going into the lumpen proletariat, right? The proletariat in rags. The Boston Globe has a useful thing on the fact that these are Mormon fanatics. There is a certain degree of clarity, but the clarity eventually comes from just too weird. Bishop Romney and the Mormon takeover of America, polygamy, theocracy, and subversion. You can get this through Tarpley.net. Go to Progressive Press of California. And this is really indispensable. It hasn't gotten, even if I do say so myself, the attention that it has, that it has actually deserved. So, no fascist gangs need apply. Now, in terms of fascism, it is time to study fascism. And, the ones that you want to pay attention to, this is a very interesting point, are the ones that focus on the early period of fascism. In other words, the buildup of fascism, fascist seizure of power, and then the institutional changes. In particular, it's better to have a book that focuses more on the early phase than on, say, the World War II phase. And even the mass extermination of Jews, Soviet war prisoners, gypsies, Slavs, all kinds of people, mainly Jews, caught up in the mass murder, right? The genocide aspect of it. That also is to some degree a separate theme. Here's the point. If you look at fascism from our own chronological position. So here we are in 2016, and we look back at fascism as it was, say, in Italy and Germany in 1939, 1940. You're going to miss the point, because once fascism has taken power, it begins to look like a very traditional form of bureaucratic authoritarian police state. In other words, a top-down dictatorship. But the problem is, how did it get to be created? How was it installed? And in order to understand that, you have to see that fascism comes on the scene with a tremendous radical anti-establishment cover, with a tremendous polemic against the old order, right? That the bourgeois politicians, the socialist international, the social democrats, the trade unions, all of them are rotten. All of them have sold out. And when you see Trump insulting, you know, every politician who crosses his path, that's an integral part of fascism. In other words, the idea that you're essentially mocking and satirizing in this violent, vulgar, obscene way that Trump has, that's essentially the young Mussolini, making faces like Trump does. Young Mussolini all the way. This is the part that is not known. In other words, the idea that fascism comes on the scene is a tremendous anti-establishment, radical protest movement, and it has intellectuals, and it has unionists, it has warmongers, it has all these people. War veterans are very big, obviously. Crazed petty bourgeois, and it's like a circus. And it comes to town, it seizes the institutions, and then it destroys unions, any other organization, assassinates some people, breaks up parties, breaks up other kinds of political opposition. Get the idea? So you got to look at, try to think about fascism as you would have seen it going into it, right? Like you're in Italy in 1920, 21, 22. What does it look like as you go into the abyss of fascism? Similarly, Germany, right? 32, 33. What does it look like as you go in? How does the regime consolidate itself? In other words, see it from the other chronological point of view, not a post hoc analysis, but a prospective analysis as it would have been at that time. So what do you have? There's Daniel Guérin, right? This is undoubtedly a serious study. It's about 300 pages in the French edition, which I have here. It is heavily documented, right? It's got hundreds of footnotes. And it has the various chapters, who paid for fascism, the troops, mysticism, fascist demagogy, fascist tactics, the plebeians, the real fascist doctrine, fascism against the working class, economic policies of fascism, and the farm policy of fascism. So all this is very interesting. And he basically gives you a chapter would have one of these things like mysticism, a general presentation, then what happened in Italy, what happened in Germany. So this is actually very useful. And it's the part of fascism that you haven't been told about. The Holocaust we know about, World War II we know about, but how did this come in? How did it reshape society? What does the corporate state really mean, or Ständestaat, as we have it in Germany? You have this guy, Franz Neumann, German. It's called Behemoth. It's also a useful study, probably a little bit less systematic than Guérin. This is a guy, though, who he went to work for the Americans after that. He's one of the founders of the Free University of Berlin. Then there's Ignazio Silone. Ignazio Silone, I think the best writer of this group, right? He's the one who wrote Bread and Wine and Fontamara. These are classic 20th century Italian novels. But then, of course, it turns out that he was an agent of the fascist secret police, the OVRA, O-V-R-A. So whatever Guérin became, he became an anarchist and a gay activist. This does not bear on what he wrote 30 or 40 years ago. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Now, I have to remind everybody that the perspective from which I observe or intervene in these events is the one that says it is imperative that the Republican Party disappear, be broken up, be smashed into pieces as a national party, that they essentially disappear from the scene here in Washington, D.C., and that as that is happening, it is very likely that the Democratic Party will split along lines essentially of the what you see today is the Hillary Clinton campaign versus the Bernie Sanders campaign. And of course, Bernie Sanders is simply the left tentacle of the Hillary Clinton campaign designed to keep this thing together, right? In other words, he's trying to bring people back into the Democratic Party, even as they're trying to flee it. The idea being then that if you had a split of the Wall Street Democrats against the New Deal pro-labor sort of left populist Democrats, that the ideological evolution would then cast away people, fakers like Bernie Sanders, and would then be open to more radical stuff of the type that the Tax Wall Street Party represents. Now, interesting discussion with this. The way you can smash the Republican Party, I think, emerges clearly from an article current Atlantic Monthly. That would be January, February 2016 by David Frum, undoubtedly smarting still from his defeat in the debate with me at the Spy Museum a couple of years ago. But here's the idea. He's talking now about the dispossessed. In other words, the Democrats are multicultural identity politics. So if you're in one of those groups, you might get something. Mainly Wall Street, though. On the other hand, you have the Republicans who are plutocratic, right? And the whole thing is tax cuts for the rich. That's the whole thing. Why is that? Because that's who's paying the bills. In other words, the Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson, they have their own specific issues, mainly tax cuts for the rich. Adelson has his Middle East story going on, obviously. But the question is, what the people like the Koch brothers are paying for is deregulation, tax cuts, in other words, material benefits for themselves. This is why I would suggest that things like the gun issue or gay marriage or other ethno-cultural issues are held on to with so much tenacity by the Republican politician, because the Republican politician is attempting to impose a program of sacrifices, more cuts, more austerity from those same blue-collar victims, right? The bitter clingers, as Obama called them, right? The people who have been shafted. How do you appeal to them? Well, you've got to appeal to these backward ethno-cultural questions of trying to reduce the whole thing to no abortion, keep your guns, all these things. And that's a way to dupe people. In other words, those are the classic wedge issues. So what David Frum writes about, is that the Republican donor class has pulled the Republican elected officials off into this lunatic land of the Tea Party. The mentality of many of these Republicans is keep your government hands off my Medicare, right? Obama was proposing and did cut $500 billion from Medicare. He was talking about a chained CPI to reduce the Social Security escalator on the cost of living. But even as the Republican Main Street was protesting Obamacare, 30% of Republicans said they would welcome heavy taxes on the wealthy. So this means that the Paul Ryan budgets were in direct contradiction, and of course the Republicans voting for free trade sellouts. You can see what it is. Here's what Frum writes. I think he knows some of these people. As a class, big Republican donors could not see any of this, or would not. So neither did the politicians who depend on them. Against all evidence, the Republican leaders interpreted the Tea Party as a mass movement in favor of the agenda of the Wall Street Journal editorial page. One of the most dangerous pleasures of great wealth is that you never have to hear anybody tell you that you are completely wrong, that your head is screwed on in the wrong direction. So it means the way you destroy the Republicans is to come forward with issues, raise issues, force them to confront issues which split the white working class base of the Republican Party on the one hand from the super rich donors of the Koch, Sheldon Adelson, and so forth type. And that's the hope, right, that could happen. Now, here we have an expression of this. Michael Gerson was a Bush speechwriter, and he writes for the Washington Post. And in today's Washington Post, Friday, January 8th, the article is called, "What If the Worst Happens?" And he says, I know you're thinking Cruz, but Cruz is not the worst, he says. He's the Tea Party. He would, guarantee defeat. But the worst outcome is Trump. And a couple of comments here from Gerson. If Trump were the nominee, the GOP would cease to be. That could go on a bumper sticker. If Trump were the nominee, the GOP would cease to be. And as we continue, ethno-nationalist beliefs professed by the demagogue Trump have followed some of America's worst instincts, right? The dark places of the American mind to which Trump, like Senator Joe McCarthy, has access. Trump would deface the GOP beyond recognition. And now here's a good one. American political parties are durable constructions, but they have been broken before by powerful, roiling issues such as immigration and racial prejudice, obviously sectionalism, secessionism, slavery. But many Republicans could not vote for Trump, but would have a horribly difficult time voting for Clinton. The humane values of republicanism would need to find a temporary home, in other words, in the shipwreck, a lifeboat, which would necessitate the creation of a third party. How about that? A third party to split the Republicans. This might help elect Clinton, but it would preserve something of conservatism held in trust out of the hope of better days. Yeah, your problem is that you followed the Tea Party, who are right-wing, fascistoid radicals in many cases, and they're not conservative at all. There's nothing conservative about them, but you did it. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. So now let's just take a look who's ahead, right? We did do that in-depth study of the Cruz campaign in Iowa, which revolves around strategic communications laboratories of Britain, and they are associated with overthrowing governments in places like Nepal, and others. They profile voters, they get out the vote, and they do dirty tricks, as we can see, right? They try to, suppress voting. They put out false information, all kinds of things, right? And they say, well, that's how we do it. Now, in terms of, who's ahead, really, You got to understand a couple of things about Iowa. I have done Iowa myself in 1988, when the governor was also Governor Braindead or Branstead. There's no comparison between the difficulty of a caucus state and the difficulty of a primary state, because with a primary election, you go to a polling place. There are lots of them. You go in there, you cast your ballot, and you're out within 10 or 15 minutes if it's well balanced. You can do it on your lunch hour. You can do it after work. You can do it anytime. But the caucus, especially the Democratic one, but the Republican is similar, you've got to go there at, I think, 7 o'clock sharp. You got to be there, and you got to stay there for at least an hour, maybe an hour and a half. Now, it also means, therefore, you have got to have a tremendous emphasis on getting out the vote. So now, seeing all this, Byron York, right, a patrician or trying to look like a patrician, writer for the Washington Examiner, which was a rather interesting print newspaper. They couldn't keep it going in print. They give it to you in the subway. But now it's still on the internet. So, his argument is, Byron York, in Iowa, Trump could be closer to Cruz than people think. And I'm afraid this does not have really very much, in the way of solid, evidence going. I think, more convincing is Timothy P. Carney, also writing in the Washington Examiner, how the Trump fall could happen. Remember, in a normal poll, it's, is it a poll of adults? Is it a poll of registered voters? Is it a poll of likely voters? And that means that you've got to talk to them and see, did you vote last time? Will you vote this time? On and on. Here's one from the New York Times, cited by Carney. Trump never rises above 30%, even after the minor candidates begin to drop out and the undecideds decide. Cruz wins Iowa. Cruz becomes the evangelical candidate and sweeps the South. The Christie, Kasich, Rubio, Bush establishment becomes one candidate. The others are forced out. And if it's a three-way race, according to this analysis, Trump cannot win. And Carney says that has got a lot going for it. Naturally, these people are all, they're not immune to the lure of, big bucks, but if they're writing against Trump, it might, you know, indicate a certain seriousness. So, he says the most recent poll is, Cruz and Trump neck and neck at 31%. But the idea is that Trump is going to underperform. The nature of the caucuses suggests that Trump will underperform the polling. In other words, fewer people, because these are, you know, they're the crazed petty bourgeoisie coming out for Trump. How about this? According to the Des Moines Register, the Trump organization in Iowa, if we can call it that, they had a statewide gathering of precinct captains, right? Now, it means that it's about 1,681 precincts in Iowa. Each one of those has a precinct caucus, right? That's what it is. It's a precinct caucus. So, the Des Moines Register said when the Trump group had all their precinct captains come together, they had 160 out of 1,681 precincts. So 10% and actually less, fewer than 10%, of the, precinct, captains or, leaders showed up. The Register says, Des Moines Register, many of the people at this gathering admitted to having a feeble grasp of the caucus process, right? All kinds of dirty tricks, right? People lock the doors. They send people to the wrong place. They dupe them. Precinct captains ideally should identify with and connect with all the supporters of Trump, say, in a precinct. They help supporters line up babysitters. They organize rides to and from the caucuses. It's a rough job for someone who has never been to a caucus. And in most Iowa precincts, there will not be a Trump precinct captain. Ted Cruz has a formidable operation. Chris Christie has many Iowa veterans on his side Rubio will have a stronger ground game than Trump. All three. So Cruz, Christie, and Rubio have a chance, a decent chance of beating Trump in the caucuses. Now then, go on to New Hampshire. What do we got now? Trump 25 to 30%, Cruz at 10 to 15, and then the establishment guys, Rubio, Christie, Kasich, and Bush, 45%. If the establishment vote picks up on any one of those, then Trump is in trouble. Here's the other one. Trump has a 44% unfavorable rating in the latest public policy polling surveys. Now, the Trump argument is people are ashamed to admit that they support Trump. We'll see what the status on that is. If this poll, public policy polling, asks voters, who's your second favorite? 7% choose Trump, means that's not so good. He's fifth in the second place. Undecided New Hampshire voters have an 86% unfavorable view of Trump. 86% unfavorable. Now, there's also an argument. This is now Harry Enten at 538. This used to be the New York Times. You remember Nate Silver, 538? Okay, now we got to go to 538. So you got to be checking something like Real Clear Politics and then go over to 538. And his argument is, and this is complex, you better go read it, to win in Iowa or New Hampshire, it may be better to poll worse nationally. In other words, it's more important to look at the state polls. Look at the state polls, because that's how people are going to be voting now in less than a month. So the idea is if you're polling higher in the national poll than you are in the state, that does not look good for you, because it means that you're well known, but you're not getting the people to come to you. In other words, your upside is limited. Your ceiling is closer to your actual polling than if, suppose, you have a low national rating, right, in the percentages, but then at the same time you're doing better in that state. So better to be leading in the individual state. And he goes through a complex regression analysis. Oh my God, run for the hills, a regression analysis of how this all works. Now, of course, he's got the provisos. This may not be the story this year, but the idea is that if you're Trump and you're polling, you know, 35-40% nationwide, if you're lucky, then that's not going to translate into a similar result in that state. And this is why there's so many surprises. Remember that in 2008, it was Huckabee, and then last time it was Santorum, Diabolorum. So those guys did better as they started with lower numbers in Iowa, and then they had an upside. So back in a minute on Gold Crisis Radio. Welcome back to our final segment here on Friday, the 8th of January, kicking off 2016. We have limited time every week with this, so let me urge you. If you want to look into the halting twice of the trading in the Chinese stock market, I think we have to talk about the incompetence of Comrade Xi and Comrade Li, and above all, their adamant line, no stimulus. Well, you take away the stimulus, you're going to get a breakdown crisis, right? In the U.S., if you have no stimulus and no QE and no ZIRP, right, zero interest rate policy, then you're gonna go over the cliff, right? That's just the way it is. Naturally, we demand, the Tax Wall Street Party wants to see the seizing of the Federal Reserve, $6 trillion in 0% long-term federal credit, so we can refinance the student loan burden and get 30 million jobs going in the infrastructure segment, and the Wall Street sales tax, so we can restore the federal budgets. But otherwise, what Xi and Li have done, it essentially shows that they're incompetent and that they're not really able to launch the renminbi as a world reserve currency. there's growing understanding that their statistics have been faked, that their 7% growth rate is not realistic. So we've got that. The other question is Saudi Arabia, right? Take a look at the morning briefing this week at Tarpley.net, and you'll see what I had to say about the Saudis, right? And David Ignatius in the Washington Post of yesterday, I guess it is. Yeah, the Fragile House of Saud. Sorry, Wednesday, January 6th. It's fragile. That Saudi monarchy could go bye-bye at any point. And panic is the word, right? What the Saudis are doing is panic. But, of course, Charles Krauthammer tells us that if the House of Saud fell, Iran would become the undisputed regional hegemon and an emerging global power. For the United States, that would be the greatest geopolitical setback since China fell to communism in 1949. Are we mad that the United States depends on a feudal Dark Ages monarchy in Saudi Arabia with no legitimacy, no human rights, and so forth? But let's just get back to this question to sort of sum it all up, right? Fascism. There is a wonderful Latin proverb called Principiis Obsta. Nip it in the bud would be a good English translation, right? Wehret den Anfängen in German. And the idea is when you see a fascist movement arrive on the scene, you've got to round them up, disarm them, and send them up the river fast. Don't let them get any momentum. Who tells us these interesting facts? Well, it's essentially, these are quotes from Hitler and from Dr. Goebbels, right? So this is fascist tactics. When the goons show up, you got to fight back, right? You got to shut them down. Here's what Hitler says in retrospect. Only one danger could have stopped our development, Nazis. If the enemy had understood what was happening starting on the first day and had responded with the most extreme brutality, he could have broken up the core of our new movement, says Hitler later on. Dr. Goebbels, if the adversary had known how weak we were, he probably would have reduced us to nothing. He could have crushed us in the first beginnings of our work, okay? Now you tell me in retrospect what's better. In the case of Mussolini, this is the classic quote that everybody should know. As Mussolini's march on Rome in October 1922 was nearing the Italian capital, a general, Badoglio, later became head of the country for a while, said to the king, look, 5 minutes of gunfire and fascism will be over for good. What should I do? And the king said, oh, no, don't do that. Leave it. We need them. We need the fascists as a counterbalance against the unions and the Socialist Party and then even the Communists. So there it is. You cannot coddle fascists. And in the case of this standoff now that's been going for a week coming in the wake of the previous one, April of 2014, you can see how dangerous this is. Now, just one other thing. What we have to pay more attention to, the Sino-British bloc. President Xi of China visited London in the middle of October. And what was created there, according to well-informed sources, and you should look at this. This is written up in the morning briefing of of Wednesday of this week, right? Wednesday, January 6th. There's a worthwhile epiphany. So what they're talking about is a complete and global Sino-British strategic partnership in October 2015. So now this is a new combination. Some some crackpot individuals were talking about the United States joining the BRICS. Well, depends on what you mean by that. But in this case, it's clear that the British have joined the BRICS. Or, if you like, the British are pulling China out of the BRICS for their own purposes. Now, the empirical phenomena are Xi and Li are economically incompetent. Their whole doctrine is no stimulus, and the thing is blown up in their faces. There's now a crackdown in Hong Kong. Remember that stuff about one country, two systems, democratic rights in Hong Kong? You can kiss that goodbye, and there's not a peep from London, because this is part of the deal. The world reserve currency. Oh, my God. You can forget that for a while, right? Who's going to put money in the renminbi when this incompetent, flailing Communist Party leadership, they go from one extreme to the next, right? Let's have circuit breakers, then no circuit breakers, then circuit breakers, and so forth. And remember, you really can't have a world reserve currency if you have exchange controls in the way that they seem to have. And then the question about leaving the European Union. Oh, leaving the European Union, as Cameron is vociferating about, this would be coherent with an attempt by the British to set off on their own. Right? One of the articles that reports this stuff is from an Italian who essentially he thinks he's delighted by the perspective that Great Britain could become the new Venice. Well, it always has been the new Venice, right? Going back to Paolo Sarpi and the early 1600s, or even Gasparo Contarini in the beginning of the 1500s. The idea being the British were on their way to becoming a larger Switzerland. I mean, they've used Netherlands also in these arguments. The special alliance with China catapults the British back to the center of Asia, the political and economic dynamo of the world. And this is in the tradition of Venice and everything that they did. Read this. This is worth reading at tarpley.net in the briefing for Wednesday, the 6th of January. This is not good news for humanity. This is going to bring out the worst on the Chinese side and the worst on the British side. By the way, each of these partners is going to attempt to betray the other. So this is unstable, it's dangerous, and we'll have to see where they take it, right? Where will this thing go? So that's the watchword for 2016. Beware the Sino-British bloc, the Anglo-Chinese alliance, is now above the horizon, and it's very dangerous. See you next week on Coffee.net.